going to bring us almost exactly to the halfway point in the story. And we're going to actually be looking at four different stories that all happen at the same time. It's one of those fun, some of my favorite movies of all time are the ones that tell four different stories from four different perspectives, and then they weave them together. So like while this is happening, they show you that this is happening at the same time, while this is also happening, and then at the end of the movie, the end of the story, they all come crashing back together and you realize they were all connected the whole time. That is how author of 1 Samuel chooses to end this book. And it is a ton of fun, but it is four chapters. So let us get right to it with our review. We've seen this a bit. This is the last Sunday I'm going to do it in this format. But Judges, we saw, was a march to the bottom. And we've been seeing that God is going to use Samuel and has been using Samuel at this point in the story. Samuel is dead to start the journey back to the top. And it's through his legacy that God is going to restore Israel to the glory that he originally intended for it to have. But they were warned in this process, if they chose a king other than God, if they chose a human king, that was going to end badly for them, because that king would only want to take from them. He would not be someone who actually ended up benefiting them. But they went ahead and they chose Saul anyway. They made the bad decision and chose Saul. But in spite of their bad decision, in spite of their choice of a human king, God made a promise to Israel. And he said that even though you have chosen poorly, I am still not going to forsake you. I am still going to be your God. I am still going to be your leader. And behind the scenes, he is still going to be their king, even though they have chosen an earthly human being. Saul, his pride ends up being his downfall, leading him to make sinful decisions. And as a result, God said he is going to take that kingdom away from him. There was the illustration of Samuel's garment being ripped. And he said to Saul, like the garment is being ripped, this kingdom is going to be ripped out of your hands, and you will no longer be the king over Israel. Instead, I'm going to replace you. I'm going to replace you with a man who is after my own heart. That's how God introduces this new character, the character that we have come to know, David. And David has now been anointed as Saul's replacement. He's the one who is a man after God's own heart. He is the king that God chose rather than the one that the people chose. And he is the one that is going to now take over and lead Israel. But up until this point, David has not gotten to realize that promise. David has been on the run. David, as we left him last week, is actually living in the land of the Philistines. And the Philistines are like the arch enemies of Israel. They want Israel to be destroyed. And as a result, they are going to war, and David is living right in their midst. And that's exactly where this chapter picks up. Because it says, in those days, the Philistines, where David is currently living, gathered their forces for war, to fight against Israel. And Achish, he's the king over the Philistines at this point, says to David, understand that you and your men are to go out with me in the army. And David says to Achish, or however you say his name, very well, you shall know what your servant can do. And Achish said to David, very well, I will make for you my bodyguard for life. The Philistine king says, we're going to war. David, you're coming with me, because David's been living in his land. And David says, okay, I will go to war, knowing full well that that means David is going to war against Israel. And David is kind of in a rock and a hard place here, because he knows he cannot go do war against Israel, but he is also living in the lands of the Philistines. He needs to do what his king is telling him to do. So that this should be raising a question in any reader's mind, and it certainly would have for the Israelites. How's David going to get out of this scenario? How's David going to get out of this? Because we know what he can't do, go to war with Israel. But we know what he must do, which is obey the king in whose land he is living. How is he going to get out of this? Now, Samuel had died. We saw that last week in our passages last week, that Samuel had died. But the author is bringing this back up because it's going to be significant. And he says, now Samuel had died. And all Israel mourned for him and buried him at Ramah in his own city. And this is where the author shifts into story number two. Story number one, we have David. David in his predicament. Story number two, Samuel has died, and Saul had put the mediums and the necromancers out of the land. The Philistines assembled and came and encamped at Shittim, and Saul gathered all Israel. And they encamped at Gilboa. And when Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. So in story number two, we're giving a quick recap of what has happened up to this point in Saul's life. Samuel, who was his leader, who was the one who had anointed him and had been giving him direction, he had died. And his enemies, the Philistines, are coming up in war against him. In this process, when Saul was still being obedient to God, one of the things that he had done was he had taken all the mediums, all the necromancers, all those who practiced witchcraft, and put them out of the land. He had treated them the way that the law had required, and he did not allow witchcraft to be practiced inside of the nation of Israel. That's a good thing. That was one of the good things that Saul had done, and he had accomplished this. But now the Philistines assembled, coming against him in war, we see Saul's big flaw come back up in that he is afraid. His heart trembles, and rather than turning to God, we're going to see what he does instead. Because when Saul inquired of the Lord, the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by the prophets. And when Saul said to his servants, "Seek out for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her," and the servant said to him, "Behold, there is a medium at Endor." It's this really nice planet that's out in the outer rim. It's got a forest moon. No, this is a place in Israel, Endor. And what we see here is that Saul, in his fear, turns to God. But God is no longer answering him. This is because of the sin that Saul had committed previously, where God had said, "I am no longer going to answer. I regret having made Saul king. I am no longer going to be with him. Even though I'm not going to forsake Israel, I am no longer going to be with Saul." And so the Lord has ceased to answer Saul's prayers. And the dreams, the Urim, and the prophets are just three of the ways that God used to answer kings, to communicate with kings. The prophets, of course, then being Samuel, being the primary prophet in this story. So instead, since God's not answering him, Saul says, "I know what I'll do. I'll go to a medium. I'll go to somebody who can speak to the dead." The very thing he had warred against, the very thing that the previous verses just told us he had spent so much of his energy as king putting them all out and making things right, he is now going to then do that very thing that he should have been punishing. The thing that he spent so much time warring against is the very thing that he turns to when he's scared. So Saul disguises himself, and he put on other garments and went, and he had two men with him, and they came to the woman by night. And he said, "Divine for me by a spirit, and bring up for me whomever I shall name to you." And the woman said to him, "Surely you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off the mediums and the necromancers from the land. Why then are you laying a trap for my life to bring about my death?" So this is the medium meeting with this person that she thinks is there for a reading or a witchcraft session. But she knows that the penalty for practicing witchcraft in the nation of Israel is fairly severe. It's, you know, stoning them to death. This is not something. So she does the whole, "You a cop? You know you got to tell me if you're a cop, right? Like, I know what Saul has done to all my sister witchcraft practices, all the other people who are mediums around here. There's a reason I'm the only one left here, because things didn't go so well for them. So you got to tell me." The thing that I find funny here is she says, "Surely you know what Saul has done." She knows exactly who Saul is. He is the one who has punished all her brothers and sisters, all the ones who had been practicing this sin with her. And she's like, "Hey, you know what Saul has done? Nobody in the land knows better what Saul has done than the person she is talking to, because it's Saul." And yes, he knows that this, what he is doing is the exact opposite of what he has called the people he was called to lead these people in, the exact opposite of what he should have been leading them to do. But Saul swore to her by the Lord, "As the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing." Then the woman said, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" And he said, "Bring up Samuel for me." And when the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. And the woman said to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul." Basically, the woman figures out here, look, there are two things. One, the only person who's interested in talking to Samuel at this point in time as a dead man would be the king. He's the one who would want to talk to the prophet of God. And then I think she's a little surprised because when she goes to inquire of Samuel, Samuel actually shows up. This is likely the first time that's ever happened for her. So when she sees him, she's like, "Oh, wait a minute. This has never happened before. There must be something special about this guy," and it all clicks for her. It all clicks for her that this is happening because this is Saul. This is the person who, like, the last person in the world that you would want to be doing this ceremony for. But the king says to her, "Do not be afraid. What do you see?" And the woman says to Saul, "I see a God coming up out of the earth." And he said to her, "What is his appearance?" She says, "An old man is coming up, and he is wrapped in a robe." And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground and paid homage. So the woman actually manages to summon Samuel, likely the first time in her career that this has actually happened. And as she describes it, Saul knows exactly what has happened. This is actually Samuel come back from the dead in this ghostly form to communicate with him. And Samuel says to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" Saul answers, "I'm in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me, and God has turned away from me and answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams. Therefore, I have summoned you to tell me what I shall do." The tone here is just, I love how this comes out. Samuel, after death, is called back up by Saul, and he shows up, like, already annoyed. Like, "Dude, I was dead. Like, I am in likely what's called Abraham's bosom at this point, a transition. We can talk about that in Pastor the Pastor sometime if you want." But he comes back and he's like, "Why in the world are you bugging me? I thought I was free of you. Like, I had dealt with you my whole life. You had frustrated me my entire life. What in the world are you doing disturbing me? Death was supposed to be my escape." All right? And Saul's response, "Well, I was in great distress. I'm going through a hard time. Philistines are warring against me. The God, he's not talking to me. God's not talking to me. So I turned to you. I turned to the one who used to tell me what God wanted me to do. So I asked this medium to do this sinful thing and bring you back from the dead so that I could have a conversation with you." Like, this is just all kinds of off the rails at this point. The big takeaway at this point for any Israelite reader and for us today is, wow, Saul has lost the plot. Saul is out to lunch. Saul is done. He's not thinking right. Everything is going badly for him. And Samuel says to him, "Why then do you ask me? Since the Lord has turned from you and become your enemy. The Lord has done to you as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord and did not carry out his fierce wrath against Amalek, therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day." So what Samuel says is basically the equivalent of, "Done should have known better. Like, why are you asking me? I'm dead. Even when I was alive, I already told you this was going to happen. You should have known better because I already told you, because God already told you. Remember when we were together and you didn't kill that Amalek guy the way you were supposed to? And I told you that God was going to take this kingdom from you and give it to another? And you grabbed my cloak and you ripped my cloak, and I said, just like you ripped my cloak, God's going to rip this kingdom out of your hand. Remember when I told you all that, and I told you that God was going to stop talking to you, and instead he was going to put into place a man after his own heart, and that guy was going to be called David? You remember all this, Saul? Because you should have known this was coming. And here's the unspoken part. And instead of coming to me again to tell you the same thing you already knew, you should have obeyed what I told you the last time and turned to David, the one whom God and I both told you was going to be your replacement. You want to know what God's saying? Go to God's guy. Go to David, the one that God said was going to be the new leader. You're not the leader. David is. And had you gone to David, David would have had the answers you were looking for. Which is a point that's kind of awkward for Saul, since he's just spent like the last 10 chapters trying to kill David. He's like, oh yeah, David. Yeah, he's totally over here. I could just go talk to him, except he's not. He's with the enemy now. He's in the Philistine land. Everything for Saul has gone badly. But it's entirely because Saul at no point has come to reckon with the consequences of his actions. At any point in this path, Saul could have corrected. At any point in this path, Saul could have swallowed his pride, turned to David, and done the thing that he should have done from the beginning, which is just simply obey God. But because you did not obey the voice of the Lord and did not carry out his fierce wrath, therefore the Lord has done this thing to you today. Moreover, in spite, even more so, the Lord will give Israel also with you into the hands of the Philistines. Tomorrow, you and your sons shall be with me. The Lord will give the army of Israel also into the hand of the Philistines. And when Saul fell at once on the ground, filled with fear because the words of Samuel, and there was no strength in him. For he had eaten nothing all day and all night. So on top of all this, Samuel says, you know what? On top of all that, because here at the end of your story, you still aren't obeying, you still aren't doing what God has called you to do, by this time tomorrow, you're going to be with me. And he doesn't mean in Endor. He means in the afterlife. And not just him, but his sons too. So story number one, David's with the Philistines. They want him to go to war. Story number two, Saul, in his final act of disobedience, turns to a ghost instead of to his God. Story number three, now the Philistines gathered all the forces of Aphek. And the Israelites were encamped by the spring of Jezreel. As the lords of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds of thousands, and David with his men were passing on in the rear with the Achish, and the commanders of the Philistines say, what are these Hebrews doing here? We're going to war with the Hebrews. We're going to battle against Israel, and there's a group of Hebrews right here. What's this all about? And Achish says to the commanders, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years? And since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day. But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him. And the commanders of the Philistines said to him, send the man back that he may return to the place to which you have assigned him. He shall not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. Okay, so here's the picture. This is the Justice League going to battle against Brainiac and all his forces. And when Superman shows up, he's like, hey guys, great news. I got us another person to fight on our side. I brought the Joker. And the rest of the Justice League, Batman especially, is going, dude, that's the Joker. Why did you bring the Joker to battle? That's not going to go well for us. He is going to betray us. He is going to kill all of us. As soon as we are all fighting in this direction, we're going to feel some really pointy things right here in our back, because this is not going to go well. You brought the enemy to battle with us. And they are not okay with this idea. The Philistine commanders are saying, nope, he will not go to battle with us. That's not going to happen. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Is not this David of whom they sang to one another in dances, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s? This phrase comes back up again because David is so well renowned at this point as a fierce warrior that they're like, look, we know David. We know that Saul is at odds with David. We know that David is supposed to be the next king of Israel. What better way for David to make things right with Saul and get back into power than to kill us and to strike all of us down, win the battle, and go back and look and say, look, I defeated the Philistines. Now, won't you take me back into your kingdom? He's like, this isn't going to work. We can't take David with us. Then Achish called David and said to him, as the Lord lives, you have been honest. And to me, it seems right that you should march out and in with me in the campaign. For I have found nothing wrong in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, the Lord's do not approve of you. So go back now and go peacefully, that you may not displease the Lord's of the Philistines. Story number one, David's stuck between a rock and a hard place. Obey, but he also needs to obey. Story two, we've got Saul. And here in story number three, the Philistine army shows up and says, look, we don't want him to go with us. And David's problem in story number one is already resolved because God shows up and God allows the Philistine army to say to this King Achish, he's not going. So now David can obey and not go, and obey and not fight against Israelites. This is the point where David's story is going to go good, right? God has showed up. God has delivered him from his problem. Except that's not really story number three. So David says to Achish, but what have I done? What have you found in your servant from this day that I entered your service until now, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of the Lord, my Lord, the king? And Achish answered David and says, I know that you are as blameless in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said he shall not go up with us to battle. So things are still good between us, David, but you're not coming. Now then, rise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord who came with you, and start early in the morning and depart as soon as you have light. So David set out with his men early in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines. The Philistines went up to Jezreel. So God has rescued David from his conundrum at this point. David's going home to Philistines, to where we saw he settled last week, the land that was given to him called Ziklag. But the Philistines are going up to battle Saul. Now, when David and his men came to Ziklag, on the third day, the Amalekites, these are like the big baddies. These are the stormtroopers. These are the Amalekites, made a raid against the Negev and against Ziklag. And they had overcome Ziklag. And they had burned it with fire and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed no one, but carried them off and went their way. Here's story number three. In his rescue of David, David gets back to his home, gets back to Ziklag, and finds the entire town has been destroyed. They haven't killed anybody, but they have taken captive the women and the children. And all their families have been kidnapped by the Amalekites. And when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire, and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him raised their voices, and they wept until they had no more strength to weep. David's two wives had also been taken captive, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. So all of their families had been kidnapped and taken away, and it makes a specific point of the fact that David's two wives have been taken captive too. David's family has been kidnapped as well. That's important because of what we see next. And David was greatly distressed. You would be too. Your whole family's been kidnapped. But he's distressed because the people spoke of stoning him. Because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. And David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. I see two things here. First, there is a parallel between David and Saul. It's the fact that David was greatly distressed. The same thing was used with Saul earlier. And the way that Saul handled that, specifically the section where he was afraid of the people stoning him, was to disobey and make an offering that was not his to make. David, instead of acting out of his fear, strengthens himself in the Lord his God and turns to God to see what God wants him to do next. The other thing that I find interesting here is David's position as the leader. David is leading this group of men. We're going to see here in a second, there's about 600 men with him at this point. And they're kind of mad because their families have been kidnapped. They're so mad that they are thinking of stoning David. What they miss in their anger towards David is how entirely misplaced that anger is. We just heard David's family's been kidnapped too. David is going through the exact same pain that they are. David is distressed as much as they are. And instead of banding together with him to go out and fight the actual enemy, the Amalekites, they are turning on him because they need someone to blame. And the person who's right in front of their face is usually the easiest person to blame. But in this, David strengthens himself in his God, in God, and turns to God to say, God, what do you want me to do? And David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue after this band? Shall I overtake them? And here's the big phrase. He, capital H, God, answered him. Pursue for you shall surely overtake and shall surely rescue. So David set out, and the 600 men who were with him, and they came to the brook Besor, and where those who were left behind stayed. But David pursued, he and 400 men. 200 stayed behind, who were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor. Here's the big piece here. God has stopped answering Saul. He tried Urim, he tried the Thummim, he tried prophets, he tried dreams. God's not answering Saul. But David goes to inquire of the Lord. Doesn't need a prophet. Doesn't need dreams. God just answers. Because David is whom God has called to lead his people. And he says, yes, go, conquer him. So he goes, he takes his 600 men, they get to this brook, this Besor, and there are 200 of his 600 men. They're too tired to go forward, but David knows that God's with him. So whether he has 600, whether he has 400, doesn't matter. He's with God. He's heard about this guy Gideon. He did it all with only 300, so he's still got more than that. Let's go to battle. He lets the 200 stay behind to protect the bags, and they go out to battle. And they find an Egyptian in the open country, and they bring him forth to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate. They gave him water to drink, and they gave him a piece of cake and of figs and two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his strength revived. For he had not eaten bread or drunk water in 3 days and three nights. So they find this guy wandering around the desert. He's in a bad way. They give him food. They give him water. He revives. He's doing pretty good. And David says to him, to whom do you belong and where are you from? And he says, I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite. Interesting. And my master left me behind because I fell sick 3 days ago. We had made a raid against the Negev of the Kerethites. I know where that is. And against which belongs Judah, and against the Negev of Caleb. I know where that is too. And we burned Ziklag with fire. Through wandering in the desert, they find this guy who is abandoned by his troop, and there's no such thing as luck when you're dealing with God. But through luck, he happens to be with the band that they're seeking. And they're like, okay, you're kind of the guy we're looking for. And David says to him, will you take me down to this band? Will you snitch? Will you take me to the people that burned our village? And he says, swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this band. And when he had taken him down, behold, they were spread abroad over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of the great spoil that they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. So they said, will you take us down there? He's like, look, here's the thing. They abandoned me out here because I got sick, and they didn't think I was worth taking with them. So you fed me. You've helped me get better. You've given me water. You've taken care of me. So yeah, I'll take you down, but just promise you won't give me back to them, because if you don't beat them and you give me back, they're going to kill me. So let me be a part of you, and yes, I'll take you down, and I'll show you where they are. So they agree to this. And they go down, and they find them celebrating, enjoying all the things that they had just taken from them. And it says, and David struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped except for 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. So except for these 400 cowards who ran away at the beginning of the battle, David spends the next, like, 36 hours just killing, just, like, taking vengeance on this group, like hacking them down all night and the entire next day for having kidnapped their people. And David recovered all the Amalekites had taken. David rescued his two wives. Here's what I think is awesome. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. David brought it all back. David brought back all. God uses story to save David from the original predicament he was in. He sent him on an alternate mission to put him somewhere other than the battle he was originally going forced to go into, which is going to be even more significant here when we get to story number four. At this point, what looked like a tragedy in David's life, what looked like a tragedy in the life of his men, when God played out the rest of his story, that terrible, awful, no good thing that they spent time weeping about and wailing about, as it turns out, they've lost nothing. They got back everything that was taken from them. And God has used this to their benefit. Doubly so when we see this. When David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David, who had been left at the brook Besor, and they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him, and David came near to the people and greeted them. So the 400 are returning to the 200, so they're back to 6, and they've got everything that was taken. Then all the wicked and worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, "Because they did not go with us, the 200, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered. Except that each man," they will make this one exciting, "except that each man may lead away his wife and children and depart." Like, you have your family back, but none of your stuff. Your stuff now belongs to us. And David says, "Nope." It says, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hands the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down into the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike." And he made it a statute and a rule for Israel from that day forward to this day. David says, "Look, no, they stayed back and protected the bags. We went into battle. But no matter what role you play in this plan, God is the one who did the work. The Lord is the one who preserved us. The Lord is the one who gave this band into our hands. God is the one who defeated the enemy, not us. So who are we to keep the spoils? Your options are, we're either going to divide it up all evenly, or we're just going to give it all to God, because it's his anyway." And David here takes the opportunity to be a good leader and point out the fact that these men are equally deserving of reward, ones who went up and fight, because they did an equivalent amount of work. God was the one who did the work. They just showed up and obeyed. When David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, "Here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord." It was for those in Bethel, in Ramoth of the Negev, of Jatir, the Aror, Sifmoth, Nesthoma, no idea, and Rasel, the city of the Jeremelites, in the cities of the Kenites, and the Horam, and Borashan, and Aphek, and Hebron. If you don't know where any of those places are, here's the summary statement: for all the places where David and his men had roamed. These are the places that David stayed when he was running from Saul. And now that God has blessed him, he takes his share of the loot, and he sends it to the people who had taken care of him. David here is demonstrating his quality as a leader. In taking care of the people who took care of him, when God blessed him, he blessed them. And he's leading them well. Which is when we come back to story number four. Because now, the Philistines were fighting against Israel. And the men of Israel fled before the Philistines, and they fell slain at Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchshua, the sons of Saul. The battle had pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was bound badly wounded by the archers. Remember story two, Samuel said, "By this time tomorrow, you're going to be with me in the afterlife." Story number four, sons are dead, and Saul is laying wounded, dying on the battlefield. Everything that Samuel said has coming true. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me. But his armor bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore, Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. This is the end of Saul's life. And the thing that I find interesting is all the way back in story number one, David was supposed to be in this battle. But if we remember back to what he said when he snuck up on him in the cave, if we remember back to what David said, he snuck in and stole his spear and stole the water from his head, what he has continually told his men is that there will be a curse upon whoever it is who has the gall, the nerve, to raise a sword against the king of Israel. Whoever it is who takes the life of the king of Israel, things are not going to go well for that person. There's going to be a curse upon him. So who is it, the end of the day, shows up and takes Saul's life? But Saul himself. Saul's the one who is going to bear the curse for taking the life of the king of Israel, not David. David was saved from the battle by his God. It's Saul. Even his armor bearer wouldn't do it. But upon seeing the death of the king, he takes his own life as well. Thus, Saul died, and his three sons and his armor bearer, all his men on the same day together, just like Samuel said. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons had fled, they abandoned their cities and fled, and the Philistines came and lived in them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa, and they cut off his head, and they stripped off his armor, and they sent messengers through the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of the idols and to the people. And they put his armor in the temple of Asheroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. The reason he asked for his armor bearer to kill him was that they wouldn't mistreat him, but even in death, they bring shame to Saul. They basically strip him naked, they cut off his head, they take his body back to their temple of their foreign god, pin him up on the wall for all the nation to see. But in what I think is a picture of God not forsaking Israel, Israel doesn't forsake their king. It says, but when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard that the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men, all the good men, arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the body of the Philistines from the walls of Bethshan, came to Jabesh and burned them there. And they took their bones and they buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted for 7 days. They go and they rescue his body, burn him, and they give him a proper burial in Israel, and thus ends the story of Saul. So what is it that we learn through this? What is it that we learn from this terrible example of Saul? First, sin will undo our hard work. We see this in Saul's life. All the things he had done to lead well, when he chooses his own pride, when he chooses his own fear, when he ends up undoing all the work he had done in the first part of his kingship. And ends up going to the very mediums that he had kicked out of the kingdom. When we choose sin, when we choose fear, when we choose pride, when we choose to pursue our own will instead of God's, we will undo good things that we have done in our lives. But even in that, how we deal with our consequences can speak as loudly as the choices we made that led to those consequences in the first place. Right? So when Saul ends up speaking to Samuel after Samuel has died, Samuel is like, look, at any point in time, you could have looked at the consequences that God promised to you, accepted them, and started obeying again. You could have turned, repented, and done what God was calling you to do, but instead, your choice at every step of the way was to continue pursuing your own desires. You could have turned to David, let David be your king, because that's the one that God chosen, and things would have gone better for you. You could have at least left him alone, and things would have gone better for you. You could have just said, God, this is the consequence for my actions. I accept them, and things would have gone better for you. But instead, you fought David. You tried to kill David. You then come to me in my dead state. Dude, you just need to accept that these are the consequences for your actions. But instead, he just keeps making it worse and worse and worse for himself. We do the same thing, right? The doubling down on our bad decisions. Those choices can speak as loudly, if not louder, than the choices that led us to our consequences. And we're going to see this contrasted. When David ends up in a similar position, the way he deals with his consequences, we will see is almost entirely opposite of how Saul dealt with his. God honors obedience. We see that in David's life, the fact that he protects him from having to be the one to take Saul's life. The fact that he has his entire house kidnapped and raided, and yet he doesn't lose anything. David's obedience, in stark contrast to Saul's disobedience, is honored in the eyes of God. And then ultimately, if God says something is going to happen, it will happen. Every single thing that Samuel has said throughout his life as he was speaking for God, every single thing that he said would happen, happened exactly as God said it would. And the same thing is true for us today. When we look at the promises of God, if we look through Scripture, we know that every single thing that God has promised us, every single thing that God says is ours, whether good or bad, will happen, because God is a God who keeps his word. Let's pray. God,